Welcome to the inaugural podcast by the Society for Cardiovascular Pathology. Our society has been dedicated to furthering clinical and research knowledge in the field of cardiovascular pathology since its inception in 1985. We are comprised of a dynamic and collegial group of individuals working together to foster advancements in cardiovascular disorders. My name is Melanie Boyce, and as your host today, I am pleased to introduce you to Dr. Gail Winters, our guest of honor. Dr. Winters' name is synonymous with cardiac transplant pathology. Her extensive publications characterizing the pathologic manifestations of cardiac transplantation have led to practice-defining concepts in transplant pathology. For her extensive work in this area, she was awarded the 2019 Society for Cardiovascular Pathology Distinguished Achievement Award. She recently retired from her position at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, wherein she served in Harvard Medical School and was residency program director. Dr. Winters, it is a true honor to have the opportunity to speak with you today. Thank you so much for agreeing to be our first Society for Cardiovascular Pathology podcast guest of honor.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be part of the inaugural podcast, and I'm happy to serve as the SCVP guinea pig.
Well, first and foremost, before we get into the nitty-gritty of your career and all your incredible contributions, we want to know, how is retirement treating you? Are you enjoying the change of pace, and what do your days look like now?
Well, retirement is great. I'm not sure how much of a change of pace it is. I've done a lot of traveling, so 11 trips in the 8 months since I retired.
Wow.
And in between, I've completed projects around the house that I've wanted to get done. I got myself elected to our homeowners association. So I sort of have a part-time job, and I still have to attend meetings.
Wow, sounds like you are definitely keeping busy. You know, to delve in a little bit into your illustrious career, you know, our listeners know about your background and all of your contributions in cardiac pathology, and in particular in transplant pathology. We're really interested in how you arrived at your distinguished career path. What brought you to pathology, and in particular, both cardiovascular and transplant pathology in the first place?
Well, I did not have the most straightforward path. After completing medical school, I entered a general surgery residency. And while I liked surgery, I wasn't sure I wanted that as my career. And in those days, you could do a surgical pathology elective as a surgery resident, which I did, and essentially never left. My goal was to become a general surgical pathologist, probably in a community hospital. And then transplant happened. And so after cyclosporine was discovered in 1980, transplant programs were springing up all over the country. And the big concern of the clinicians was, who is going to read these biopsies? I was at Loyola at the time, and they decided I should be the one to do this. And I said no, mainly because I had no clue. And in those days, Dr. Margaret Billingham at Stanford, who developed the first grading system for cardiac transplant biopsies, ran courses throughout the year to teach pathologists all over the country how to read biopsies. So I attended the course, as did many SCVP members. And after that, I started reading biopsies. And the more I learned, the more interested I became, and it expanded from there. So if I could look at biopsies, could I look at a heart, and could I look at a valve? And so that's how I got into cardiac pathology. Wow. Sort of backwards. I did transplant first. I was entirely self-taught. I had no fellowship in it. So I learned with the help of textbooks and long-distance mentors who I'd call when I got into trouble, notably Margaret Billingham and Bruce McManus.
Wow, that's amazing. It's amazing how life can take us down different paths that we didn't originally intend.
Well, this was certainly not an aspiration of mine at the time I was a resident. And I often will tell the residents, you know, make the best choices you can as opportunities come along, and you can't plan everything.
Absolutely. Good lesson for all of us, especially those of us like me, just starting our careers and trying to figure out where we fit best into the greater community of academics here. And so with your extensive knowledge in this area, you know, these days we have a lot of metrics in order to assess cardiac function. We have imaging and echo that are getting more and more advanced by the day. So why is it that endomyocardial biopsy is helpful in monitoring allograft performance? What information can we get through doing this invasive procedure? In other words, why do we still do it today, even though we have all of these wonderful imaging modalities?
Well, the original idea of the endomyocardial biopsy was to diagnose rejection at a stage before it became clinically apparent. So the goal was to make the diagnosis when rejection was more easily treatable. Mm-hmm. And that's why biopsy protocols were set up, biopsying patients on a regular basis who were asymptomatic. In addition, there are a lot of processes, many of them inflammatory, that affect the myocardium and can result in similar clinical presentations. And so the biopsy is the most definitive way of differentiating these processes. I should add, in recent years, the number of biopsies performed has decreased in many programs. And since rejection is more common early in the post-transplant course, many programs have eliminated biopsies at some fixed time. So after 2 years or 5 years, they may not do protocol biopsies, but only biopsy symptomatic patients. Mm.
And then do they monitor for antibody-mediated rejection via serum levels?
Oh, that is a very good question. I think, as we'll talk about later, the whole antibody-mediated rejection question is treated differently in many different programs.
Sure, sure. Well, we won't delve into it just yet. We'll save that for a little bit later in the podcast. I did want to ask you right now, though, a little bit about your experience with the International Society for Heart and Lung Transplantation. So in 1990, the ISHLT adopted an international grading system for transplant biopsies. That grading system was then revised in 2004 to confer uniformity to our diagnoses. Now, you were chair of that meeting. Can you tell us more about the conversations and the processes that took place regarding the revision of that grading system and a little bit about how that impacted clinical management?
Yes. Well, the main focus of ISHLT 2004 was grade 2. Increasingly, clinicians at major transplant centers were convinced grade 2 rejection should not be treated, and that was supported by multiple clinical studies, mine included. In addition, and this was very concerning, grade 2 was being used as the threshold to treat in clinical trials of new immunosuppressive agents, and this was a huge concern because it didn't seem as if grade 2 behaved like the higher grades of rejection, and this could totally throw off the outcome of these trials. Therefore, we made the decision to group grade 2 with the lower grades of rejection, grade 1A and 1B, into the 2004 grade 1R, or mild rejection. As a point of history going back to 1990, our deliberations at that time, we looked at what we now know as grade 2, and we didn't know what to do with it. It was a single focus of inflammation with myocyte damage, and we didn't know if it would behave like more extensive rejection on biopsy or not. Hmm. So we purposely made it a separate grade so it could be studied, and in a sense, it worked. Now, I'm aware of some transplant centers where the clinicians are forcing their pathologists to provide their diagnosis in the 1990 grading system as well as the 2004 grading system, so they can continue to treat, quote, grade 2, something I obviously don't agree with. I would say that the other things that happened during the 2004 meeting were more housekeeping changes and much less controversial. So grade 3B and grade 4 were combined into a single grade 3R or severe rejection. Quilty A and B, which were never really shown to behave differently clinically, were combined into just Quilty. And there wasn't a whole lot of AMR discussion. the 1990 grading system said that vascular rejection, as it was then called, could be mentioned if present. And in 2004, we said, well, we could grade it as AMR 0, it's absent, or AMR 1, it's present, and that was about it.
So really a simplification or a slimming down of the original 1990 classification with some adjustments to the original 2R grouping.
Right. I mean, that was the biggest change that had the most significance.
So you had mentioned AMR, which for our listeners is antibody-mediated rejection. I'm really interested in how you diagnosed this in your practice. Did you use immunohistochemistry? Did you use immunofluorescence? And what were the advantages and disadvantages that you see in your extensive experience to both?
Well, we evaluated AMR first by looking for the characteristic histologic findings, and if present, we would order a C4D by immunoperoxidase. We'd also order a C4D if it was requested by the transplant cardiologist due to clinical concerns. Mm-hmm. And I think whether you use immunohistochemistry or immunofluorescence is somewhat based on an individual preference and department logistics. So, for example, if you get high-quality immunoperoxidase delivered to you in the main department and immunofluorescence is over in a different building, you might opt for immunohistochemistry.
Sure.
It also depends what markers you use. So there are some markers, C3D and HLA, that need to be done by immunofluorescence. In addition, there was a Banff conference on allograft pathology in 2009, and the conclusion there were that the two methods were equivalent, and you should do one or the other, but you really don't need to do both.
And did you ever use CD68 immunohistochemistry or 163 to look for histiocytes within the vasculature or small capillaries?
Well, yes, we tried CD68. And I know a lot of people find that helpful. We really did not.
Okay. So in you seeing so many transplant biopsies, many of us are looking for guidance on what can be the biggest pitfalls that we can run into when we're diagnosing rejection in an endomyocardial biopsy? And have you seen very many of these? And what tips or techniques can you provide us to help us from falling into the same trap you've seen before in your career?
I think the biggest pitfalls are other inflammatory processes that are not rejection. And so you see inflammation in the myocardium. If all inflammation was rejection, it'd be relatively easy. But things like ischemic injury, Quilty effect, infections, and even post-transplant lymphoproliferative disorders can appear as inflammation.
Sure.
I think part of the prevention of falling into the pitfalls is awareness. You have to think of them. And sort of in the back of your mind, now, the lymphocytes look a little funny. Could this be PTLD? Mm-hmm. If you don't think of it, you'll never diagnose it. I think there are a number of textbooks and atlases out there, but in doing them myself, you know you pick the perfect example to put in the book or put in the atlas, and those aren't always real life. Those that do fellowships are lucky in the sense that they typically learn from one or more experienced pathologists. The person I really feel sorry for is the pathologist out there that is suddenly giving the duty of reading transplant biopsies, and they really have nowhere to go, such as the course Margaret Billingham did in the 1980s.
Well, those are excellent points that not all inflammation is created equally when it comes to these endomyocardial biopsies for transplant rejection. So,
I think that is where people get into the biggest trouble.
Absolutely. So, Dr. Winters, in your experience, now looking back at where the field of allograft transplantation evaluation has been and where it's going, what do you think the current state is, and where do you see the future of this field going?
Well, I have to say the current state of allograft evaluation is still the endomyocardial biopsy. I've watched for years as other non-invasive techniques tried unsuccessfully to put the biopsy readers out of business. The most recent of these techniques is molecular markers. Mm-hmm. These often can tell us everything is okay or quiet within the myocardium, or if something is going on, at which point you do a biopsy. So they may reduce the incidence of biopsies, but until they get more specific, they won't eliminate the biopsy completely.
Well, I like that for job security.
Well, I often said that I would still be reading biopsies when I retired, and indeed that happened.
Are you? Are you indeed? So you have had an incredibly impactful career, and with numerous manuscripts, numerous speaking engagements. We're curious, which manuscript are you most proud of, and why?
Well, I went through and I looked at that. That's actually an easy question.
Is it?
The manuscript was published in circulation in 1995, and the official title is Natural History of Focal Moderate Cardiac Allograft Rejection: Is Treatment Warranted? But what it became known as is the Don't Treat Grade 2 paper.
I am familiar with that one, and that is an excellent publication. With so many to choose from, I'm really impressed that you had that, you know, one ready to go and had a great answer. It sounds like it was incredibly impactful in the clinical realm as well. So similarly, did you have a pivotal experience in your career that you were most proud of?
Well, can I pick three?
Sure.
I would say, in looking back, the first would be the first abstract I ever presented, and that was at the American Heart Association meeting, not a pathology meeting. And remember, I was not going to go into academic pathology, but I was encouraged by my cardiac transplant colleagues to submit an abstract to this meeting, and I thought I'd just go stand by my poster. Well, it got accepted as a platform presentation in a large clinical section. And this section was moderated by two very well-known transplant physicians, and I was terrified. But I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And I got through it, and afterward thought, well, that was kind of fun. Maybe I should try that again. So that was number one. I think number two was being asked by Margaret Billingham to participate in the 1990 grading system. And number three was moving to the Brigham in 1992, where I found a whole new world of pathology and three great colleagues, Fred Schoen, Rick Mitchell, and Bobby Padera, who I worked with until I retired last year.
It's so interesting to hear what stands out to you as you go through your career and where those pivotal moments were. Thank you for sharing those with us. Dr. Winters, any closing thoughts as we conclude this very first or inaugural session of the SCVP podcast?
I think the history is always important in these things. And sometimes I find residents that don't know why there's an R after the one R or two R, and it's revision, and why did that all happen? And so it's fairly unusual to be able to go back and be at the start of something like many of us were with transplant biopsies. It was a new thing, and we had to learn as we went along in the early days. And so keeping the perspective and the history in mind, I think, is both interesting and important.
I couldn't agree more, and we thank you for taking the time to share a lot of the historical perspectives and experiences that you have with us today. It's such a honor to really have you here, and your insights and experiences are really inspirational to all of us. We wish you the very best in your retirement, and thank you again for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much.
So this concludes our inaugural podcast for the Society for Cardiovascular Pathology. We welcome new members of any experience level and enjoy the collegiality that our society brings to our careers. Please visit us on the web at www.scvp.net to learn more.